Hiya, gang.
Yesterday, today, and tomorrow, a special program presented each week at this time by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Today, a recorded documentary on baseball, the national pastime. You will hear bright-eyed youngsters who will be the stars of tomorrow. You will hear the voices of the stars of yesterday, Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Clark Griffith, Connie Mack, Joe Cronin. The stars of today, Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Jackie Robinson, these and many others. And the story of why the congressional investigation of baseball appears headed for a flop. And now your narrator, Kenneth Banghart.
Baseball. You either like it or you don't. But millions of Americans like it, and for many of those millions, it's more than a game. It's a sort of a disease. Small towns have been known to feud for years over a single incident in some remote game between their heroes. But feuding is not limited to small towns. Witness the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants. Baseball is an important part of American life. In Korea today, the names of famous players are often used by our GIs as passwords in the heat of battle. In the last war, President Roosevelt recognized the importance of baseball in home morale by ordering the game to go on. Baseball? Well, baseball is baseball. And many a youngster learns how to throw and catch before he learns his multiplication table. And nowhere in the country is this underscored more than in the famed Little League of America. This week, we visited one of these leagues in Clifton, New Jersey, and heard the youngsters firing professional questions at their coaches, Mickey McDonald of the U.S. Rubber Company, sponsor of the league, and former Dodger Art Deedy.
Are there any questions, fellas? Yeah.
Well, I play second base, and if there's a man on first, they can't run in the Little League. They can't run until the ball passes the batter. And, well, if the catcher drops it, if it's a passed ball, and I'm playing for a left-hand batter. I expect him to swing. Who should take the throw, the shortstop or the second baseman?
Shortstop should take the throw.
Why does Jackie Robinson hold his bat high above his head?
I really don't know.
It's more
comfortable for him, and it's the habit that he's gotten used to, and he probably feels that he does a better job that way.
Well, I was reading the paper, and I heard a Jackie Robinson, when he's stealing a base, when he slides, he has a certain kind of a corkscrew slide. I want to know, what is it like?
Well, that's a little difficult to answer. Sports writers get different ideas.
What is the best way of a catcher to give the single to the pitcher?
Well, you got to get down in a squat position. You have your glove on this knee and just let it extend out comfortably. That protects your signs from the third base coach. Your right knee almost points straight out toward the pitcher. In so doing, that protects your signs from the first base coach. But for goodness sakes, after covering yourself up, don't put your fingers away down so that everybody in the park can see them underneath your legs.
Well, I'm using mitts. Should you use a three-finger, four-finger, or five-finger? Which do you think would be better for picking up grounders and fly balls and things like that?
And I would say the only thing that I would recommend is that you thought you saw a glove and it looked good to you, and after trying it on, everything fitted well in your hand, and you thought you could do a good job with that glove, that would be the glove to get and get used to it, but you got to get used to it.
Should a young pitcher practice his curveball or his fastball?
Well, I would say that until you can control a fastball, never fool around with a curve.
Well, if you're in a pickle, and in between third and home, and you're trying to get back to third, should you dive feet first or head first?
The first way you can contact that bag, that's the way to do it. But if you slide head first, you always have a much bigger chance of getting injured, and that's why we don't recommend it.
Members of the Little League are under 12 years old, the stars of tomorrow. A dozen years ago, there were only three teams in one state. Today, there are more than 2,000 teams in 37 states, Hawaii, Canada, the Canal Zone, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. The Little League World Series is in the offing, and this familiar tune will swell from the stands. Those cheers were made several years ago by 350 youngsters at an NBC baseball clinic, and they were for the greatest of them all, George Herman Ruth.
Hello, boys and girls.
Oh, Babe!
That's the way. Just call me Babe.
Why do they call you Babe?
Why do they call me Babe? Well, I'll tell you. A few years before you were born, I was playing with the Baltimore Orioles. And when I went to Baltimore, and in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was my first appearance. And when the coach saw me come in, he said, "There comes this big baby." So Baby has stuck to me ever since. Hello, Sonny. What's your name?
Billy Ruthven.
How old are you, Billy?
12 years old.
12 years old. Well, you're a pretty big fellow to be 12. You got a favorite team?
Yes, the Dodgers.
Uh-oh.
How about that?
There were some cheers and boos in that. I don't know. What is your name, Sonny?
Bob Sullivan.
Bob Sullivan. Say, we got a lot of Irish around here this morning. How old are you?
14.
14. You got a favorite team?
The Giants.
Oh, the Giants. Well, it looks like you got a few Giant rooters out there. Now, what is your name, Sonny?
Edward.
Edward who?
Sheedy.
Sheedy, huh? Well, how old are you?
Seven.
Have you got a favorite team? What is it?
The Yankees.
In his later years, Babe Ruth devoted much of his time and his money to youngsters who would be the citizens of tomorrow. And another of yesterday's baseball greats has never forgotten the youngsters either. Let's see, you'd have to be 60 years old if you ever saw Connie Mack play baseball. But until his retirement as manager last year, his waving of a scorecard to coach his players was familiar to millions of present-day fans. Among them were the children.
Is your real name Connie Mack?
Well, I guess, dear, I'll tell you, to be frank with you, no, it's not. It's a very long name. And it was cut down so that the newspaper boys would have a chance to get it in once in a while. The real name was Cornelius McGillicuddy.
Mr. Mack, I heard that you were an awful good man, and that whenever you do get mad and swear, the worst thing you say is, "My gracious." Is that true?
Well, Freddie, I guess that's pretty near true, because I don't like to hear the swearing. I tell them there that swearing never helped any ball player's success.
But the stars of today also are heroes to the youth of the land, and these stars of today were the wide-eyed hero worshippers of yesterday, hoping that someday they would become great ball players. One of these is Ted Williams of the Boston Red Sox. We asked Ted if he had a message for the youngsters.
First of all, I'd like to tell them that everything that I've been fortunate to have and to see and to do, I owe all to baseball. To me, it's the most wonderful game that's ever been invented, and that, like I say, I owe everything to it. It develops so much in a person. I mean, sportsmanship, aggressiveness, builds their bodies up. Everything about baseball is so wonderful.
Ted Williams' boss is Joe Cronin, another of yesterday's stars. And when we asked him about baseball as a future for an ambitious boy of ability, this is what he told us.
We had a dinner honoring Johnny Pesky, our great little shortstop. And at this dinner, Johnny thanked all present for being so fine to him. And I think it was indicative of what the baseball offers the youth of America. Johnny was a clubhouse boy in Portland, Oregon, the Coast League, and went right on through the ranks, 2 years in the minors. He was in the big leagues and been a star since. And he thanked those people for being able to buy a home for his mother, being able to live well. He said he didn't want to be a millionaire, he just wanted to live like one.
And that's the dream of all of them, the big time and the big money. Here is pitcher Bob Grimm, 22 years old, of the Yankee Farm Club in Binghamton, New York, who has his eyes set on the Yankee Stadium.
I always did like the Yankees ever since I was a kid. My father was a Yankee fan, and I guess it's tradition. My father liked them, and I guess I had to like them, too. I just hope that someday I'll be one, that's all.
Bob Grimm is on his way up, but here's a young man who already has arrived.
My name is Leo Kiely, and I'm a rookie up here. And I've been with the Red Sox about 4 or 5 weeks now, and it's a great feeling to be up here. I come up from Louisville. Played in Birmingham in 1950. I was at Scranton in 1949, at Wellsville in 1948. I used to dream at night of playing in the big leagues. Well, now that I'm here, I'm going to try to do the very best I can to make a great ball player.
Tradition and love of the game. Any old-timer will tell you that's all very fine, but he'll also tell you that for many a ball player, there's the bitter before he tastes the sweet. In the minors, it means long bus rides after a night game. It means ordinary food in ordinary restaurants and restless sleep in restless hotels. It also means low pay. For instance, the average pay for a ball player in Class D leagues is $153 a month. In Class C, it's $200 a month and $233 in Class B. While hundreds of ball players struggle through in this fashion, there are others who are handed fabulous checks just to sign on the dotted line. These are known as bonus players. Here's Dodger manager Chuck Dressen's philosophy on that.
There's a lot of these boys that's got a large bonus, and it's a lot of money for a young kid, and he don't have the desire. I think when a fella starts out, a young fella, if he's got one thought in mind and he just wants to play baseball just for the love of the game, then when you become good, why, you get paid for it. Look at the fella that's making all the way from $60,000 to $100,000. I don't know any other business you could make that in. Why, when you get older, why, it's not work for you. It's still play. I get a kick out of it regardless of all the tough things that happen to you. I still get a kick out of it because I really started out to play the game because I like it. And I went through that with Mr. Wrigley of the Chicago Cubs. We were talking about it not very long ago. And I said, if I'd have put as much effort and time in some other business, I'd say with your gum company that I have in baseball, I would probably be the president of your company.
Yes, some ball players make big money, more money than presidents of some companies. But so do the club owners. And recently, a group of congressmen decided they would have a look-see into this business of baseball. They wanted to find out if the so-called reserve clause violated the antitrust laws. Now, the reserve clause means simply that once a ball player is signed up with a club, he cannot leave that club unless he's traded, sold, or quits. There have been long congressional hearings, but at week's end, it appears that the whole thing was much ado about nothing. That, for the most part, both the owners and the players are satisfied to let things stay as they are. Here is White Sox manager Paul Richards.
I think that without the reserve clause, baseball would be reduced to exhibitions within 2 years. The reserve clause makes it possible for the club owners to pay large salaries rather than the contrary. And also, without the reserve clause, a lot of our club owners would just have to give up, and the players then would be the big loser. Their traveling accommodations would be probably one-night stands and a bus, $2 hotels, and that sort of thing. The reserve clause is absolutely essential in baseball, and if it's investigated down to the very end, you'll find that it really develops ball players and makes it possible for a ball player to become a star.
And here's Brooklyn's Jackie Robinson speaking as a player.
You can't get away from the reserve clause. We have to have it. I'm a ball player, and I know that possibly that if we didn't have the reserve clause, I could go out and probably dicker with some other ball club and possibly get more money than you're getting here on the Brooklyn Ball Club. But what would happen if all the better ball players didn't have the reserve clause? They could go over to the clubs that have a lot of money and offer their playing services there for one series, and then when they go to another series, they may need this particular ball player. If that didn't happen, they could go offer their services. The reserve clause got to stick as far as all the ball players are concerned.
One congressman suggested that the easiest way to break up the so-called baseball monopoly was to organize four major leagues. but the subject of just three major leagues long has been a problem for club owners. The Pacific Coast League feels that it should become the third. Clarence Rowland, president of that league, presents his argument.
Our goal that we're shooting for is Major League for the Pacific Coast, and that takes in the Pacific Coast as it is today. These eight cities that now represent the Pacific Coast League have been together for a period of 45 to 50 years, and they've taken the bitter with the sweet, and now they've come to a point where they realize the crest of the wave is about to carry something on. They want to ride it together, and we want to bring Major League here to the coast as Pacific Coast Baseball League, classified as a major. I've heard a lot of things said about the size of some of the cities in our league. There are small towns in every league. But the thing about our situation here, the relative that they're referring to, I imagine, is Sacramento and San Diego, but we could enlighten some of the Major League club owners that those two towns outdrew members of their own league.
Chuck Dressen was a Pacific Coast League manager before he came to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Here are his views.
Well, I think that most of those fellows out there are smart enough to know that they don't have the parks to accommodate Major League crowds. And they say, some say they don't have to have it. Well, you do. If you're going to have Major Leagues, you got to pay Major League salaries. Well, let's just look at it this way. Here's the two major leagues right now, the American and National League, and they're crying for ball players. So where are they going to get enough ball players to make the third major league to compete with these two leagues? I don't think they can do it.
But while Congressmen wrangled over the reserve clause and the Pacific Coast League bid for a place in the sun, the major leagues were in the midst of a pennant race. At least it was a race in the American League. At the beginning of the season, the Chicago White Sox ran away from the flock and became the darlings of underdog lovers. But something has happened. We asked manager Paul Richards if he could put his finger on it.
Well, I'll not even try to put my finger on the reason for the Sox so-called slump. I think it was just a natural reaction to a lot of things. But I will try to put my finger on a couple of things that might bring us out of it and put us back into contention, which I believe we will be in a short time. Our pitching is going to be a lot better from here in. We're going to have a lot of off days to spell our better pitchers. And I know that Eddie Robinson and Chico Carrasquel, Jim Busby, and our new addition Ray Coleman and Al Zarrillo will do better hitting than they've been doing in the last 6 weeks. And I, for one, am convinced that the White Sox are a long ways from out of it.
This from manager Steve O'Neill of the enigmatic Boston Red Sox.
Three clubs right now that have got a chance to win the pennant. Of course, I'm not counting Chicago out by any means. They're about seven games behind the present time. But I think that either one of the three clubs can win it. And we do hope that it will be the Red Sox.
Al Lopez, manager of the red-hot Cleveland Indians.
Since the beginning of spring, I said that the team to beat would be the champions, and that was the New York Yankees. Well, since I've been in the league this year, and I've seen all the clubs, I still feel like the Yankees are about the toughest club in the league, especially for us to beat. We were hit by some injuries first part of the year, and I think that's what hurt us the most. I think if we hadn't had those injuries, that we might have been out five or six games out in front right now.
Joe DiMaggio speaks for the world champion Yankees.
Cleveland, I think, is the toughest team right at this point. They certainly have showed the hottest streak, but that is because of their pitching. When you have the first four like they have, that first line pitching, you really got something. Those fellas can go out and win a ball game any time they get out to the pitch. But our ball club, I'm not discounting Osvaldo by a long shot. We still have two great pitchers, or I should say three in the front line, Lopez, Rashi, and of course Reynolds. I believe I'm looking for our club to get a little better hitting. We certainly have been getting the pitching. And I think once we get our hitting at that long ball, why, I believe we will try to wind up with the... I can't say we are going to, but I know we're going to be very close up there.
In the National League, the Brooklyn Dodgers are sailing merrily along with a lead from here to there. But Chuck Dressen has his fingers crossed.
As I've said time and time again before the season started, if we have some luck, I think we'll win the pennant. And what I mean by luck is to stay away from a serious injury like a broken leg or one of my...
Even a New York Giant fan will agree that Chuck is just wasting words, that his team has little to worry about until World Series time. Now we turn to baseball's dim past, and where better than at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York? Will Wedge, for many years a baseball writer in the old New York Sun, is librarian at the Hall of Fame, and he's showing us a picture of General Abner Doubleday. We remind him that many historians say Doubleday did not invent baseball.
Whether that is completely true, I don't know, as Doubleday's claim or the claims advanced on behalf of Doubleday has been challenged by very excellent authorities, saying that baseball had actually been known by the name of baseball earlier and had been played in New England, for instance, before the year 1839.
But Mr. Wedge shows us other mementos that recall how baseball spread to the West and the South in yesteryear. He cites Alexander Cartwright, Jr., a member of the Hall of Fame, but who was not a baseball player.
He was the originator of the some of the specifications for the diamond, including the all-important 90-foot between the bases. That was his idea when he organized the New York Knickerbockers, an amateur team in 1845. Supposed to have been the first organized baseball team of them all. He was tremendously important because he wrote some of the rules. And he furthermore carried the game westward because he got the gold fever in 1849 and joined a gold rush to California. And this is a picture of the Union prisoners playing at Salisbury, North Carolina in the Civil War and inside a Confederate stockade. That period was when the South first learned about baseball. And it was immediately after the Civil War that baseball really got going nationally and assumed the character of the national game. Returning soldiers who spread all over the country carried the game with them. One of the fellows who learned his baseball in the Civil War was Nick Young, and he learned his first baseball by watching, the team of the 8th New York Volunteers play some ball. And then he learned the game there and became a player. Later moved up and eventually became president of the National League.
So the game grew into the giant pastime that it is today. It not only provides entertainment for millions of fans, but it provides a backdrop for yarn spinning, hun swoggling, rumors, tales of thrills, and sometimes even a somber note. One of the grand old men of baseball is Washington's Clark Griffith. He's interviewed by NBC's Ray Shearer.
Well, Mr. Griffith, let's see now. You've been in baseball how many years?
Well, I'd say about 64. I started when I was 17 years old, and I'm 81 now.
That's a long time. Well, who was the best ball player you ever worked with, Mr. Griffith?
Oh, I don't know when you get to ball players or pitchers. What are you talking about?
Well, it's one ball player and one pitcher. Can you?
Well, the best ones I've ever had on the Washington Ball Club?
Yes, sir.
You mean that?
Mm-hmm, that's what I mean.
Well, the best one that had the better record, I guess, if any that I had here, was Goose Goslin. He led the league in hitting and was a great outfielder, long-distance hitter.
How about a pitcher now?
Well, nobody comparison to the great Walter Johnson.
Mr. Griffith, you're known as the old fox in trading circles. What do you think was the best trade you ever made?
Well, that's hard to say. The biggest money trade I ever made is when I sold Joe Cronin, my son-in-law, for $250,000.
He sold him to Boston.
And got another player to boot.
Now, we put this question to Chuck Dressen. Who is the best ball player you ever saw?
Best ball player I ever seen? Babe Ruth. I know Ty Cobb was a great ball player, but a different type. And I played with some great ball players. But Babe Ruth was, I would say, a superhuman man because he did something that nobody in baseball, I don't think, will ever do again, swing a bat weighed 52 ounces. We got fellas now with a lot of power, but there's nobody ever swung a bat that weighed 52 ounces, and he swung that bat pretty good, and he quit when he was one of the great pitchers. He was a good base runner, and he seldom made any mistakes, And with it, he was a showman. When he hit a home run, it looked like that he carried himself around the bases with a little different nobility or airs, if you want to call it. I don't know how you say, but some fellas hit a home run and they run around the bases and don't run. Babe Ruth went around like one of the people that applaud. Why, it seemed like every step that he knew where he was stepping.
Many a fan will tell you that Ty Cobb was the greatest. They'll also tell you he was the meanest base runner of all time. Years ago, Babe Ruth had a word to say about Cobb's prowess on the base paths.
Now, you take that Ty Cobb fellow who was very, very fast. But he out-tricked you all the time. Probably there were some fellows in there could beat him running straight away. But when they get on that base, he'd have about three jumps on you while you start to think about running. So that's why old Ty was the fastest and stole the most bases in baseball. I think you got to put Cobb down number one at that.
Recently, sportscaster Bob Wolf interviewed Ty Cobb down in Washington and reminded him that he is best known for his intense base running, that some even accused him of deliberately making his opponent hors de combat. And here's what Cobb had to say about that.
Well, I was sliding a lot, but I did not slide like the boys slide today, all up in the air and the boys tumbling around down second base. But as far as the spiking business is concerned, I could show you a lot of spike wounds on my ankles and my knees put there by basemen jumping in the air after the ball, but you never heard of me being spiked.
Now for a favorite story from Chuck Dressen.
Well, one of my favorite stories is I've always said you can't put a 40-year-old head on a 20-year-old boy, and naturally you run a club by signs. Well, I used to have one of my pet signs was on a double steal. If a man is on first and his man on third and two outs and going to work a double steal on you, I had a sign where you throw it back to the pitcher. So one day we had occasion to use this. We play in a club, Pittsburgh, and Archie Vaughn was on third, and they was going to work the double steal on us, and I give the sign, and the catcher give the sign. Now the pitcher is supposed to cut the ball off. Pitcher, he ducked and let it go through to second. The second baseman got it and seen the fellow leading from third, tearing for home. He fired to the plate, and the pitcher was in the middle of the mound. He caught the ball on the way back.
And Chuck's biggest thrill in baseball.
Naturally, when you play in a World Series, well, that's a great thrill. But I didn't play in this game, but in 1933, I was a member of the New York Giants. And the bases was full, and they put in a pinch hitter to hit against Carl Hubbin in the 11th inning, and the score 2-1 and one out. And I happen to know this fellow from the Southern League. I managed down in Nashville. He was at Chattanooga, a fellow named Cliff Bolton, and was going to play the infield in. And I run out to the center of the field and told Terry that he couldn't run very fast, and if you played back, you could make a double play, and told him how to pitch to him. And he asked me a few questions, said, "Do you think he'll pull Hubble?" I said, "No, not if you pitch outside." So they decided to play the infield back, and I left the mound no more and got back to my seat, and the ball was hit down the shortstop over to Kritz, over to Terry, and it was a double play, and the game was over. We won 2-1. If they'd played the infield in, it had been a hit, and we'd have got beat 3-2.
Jackie Robinson's greatest thrill came during the first game of the first World Series he ever played in, but it's not what you might think.
In 1947, they lined the Brooklyn Dodgers up on the third base line and the New York Yankees up on the first base line. And out in center field, I think it was Guy Lombardo's orchestra, they struck up the National Anthem. And I got a great thrill out of that simply because I felt that it was being played not only for the New York Yankees and the other Brooklyn Dodgers, but also for Jackie Robinson as well.
And Jackie Robinson, a truly great baseball player, might have added that there was more than one reason why that has been his greatest thrill in the game.
You have just heard Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a special recorded program presented each week at this time by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Next week, State Fairs. Your narrator today was Kenneth Banghart. Tonight, it's Martin Kane, Private Eye on NBC.